The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.
Now we're going to discuss the daily commute. And lots of people are talking about commuting further because they can't afford the price of accommodation in our major cities at present, or can't afford to buy. And they're talking about going and living in cheaper locations. But then the issue is, can they get a train? Can they get a bus? Or if they have to drive, how long will they be stuck in a commute? One listener says, I'm commuting 180 miles round trip every day, 90 miles each way. Can you imagine doing that? Now, we're going to start with Leslie Shoemaker. You're a counselling psychologist. You're a lecturer at Dublin Institute of Technology. You're based where in Dublin?
I live on the Finglas Road. And, actually, DIT no longer exists. We're now the Technological University Dublin.
You're right. My apologies for that and congratulations on the upgrade. Are you in Grange Gorman or are you in another location?
I'm in Kevin Street. I'm just around the corner from here. But unfortunately,
to get to work at 9 o'clock in the morning, you have to leave at what time from home?
If I am not on a bus by 7:20 in the morning, I will not get into town.
To get to work for 9 o'clock, you have to be on a bus in Dublin. You're living in Dublin City and you have to be on the bus at 20 past seven.
Well, unfortunately, what happens is if I'm not on a bus by 7:20, they're all full till after 8 o'clock. And in order for me to be in front of my students at 9 a.m., yes, I have to leave earlier and earlier and earlier. Now, I get into town about 8:15. And I now need to start disciplining myself to not just start working because I'm adding an extra hour to my workday.
Unpaid,
yes. And it's, I have to say, this Christmas was a welcome break. I realized I sort of wore myself out by putting in that extra hour because it's like, oh, I'm here. I may as well just get tucked in, start doing things. I'm not going to do that anymore.
And how many people do the same at the end of the day? Instead of leaving, say, at their time, their finishing time of 4 o'clock or 5 o'clock or whatever time it is, because of traffic, they decide, or shall I wait until the traffic dies down? And they end up effectively giving an unpaid extra hour to their employer.
But it's not even just that. That extra hour is impacting on our sleep schedule, our family meal time, exercise. That extra hour is being taken out of our work-life balance.
And what does it do to people as well, been stuck in traffic? I mean, I suppose if you are on a bus or if you're on a train, you can read. If you're in a car, so you can listen to the radio and whatever, but is it physically and psychologically wearing to be in traffic for a lengthy period of time?
I think it's been unequivocally proven. There was research done in the UK with 34,000 people, and it has come up and shown, in particular, it's the independent commuters, people who are the single person in the car. They're the ones who have the biggest impact. But it impacts backache, headaches, the wear and tear psychologically, our concentration, our ability to just be cheerful when we get in the morning. People who do public transportation and cyclists and people who walk, probably because we feel that, being on a bus, I'm a short person, I hate the bus. So I always get hit in the head with backpacks. But anyways, but for cyclists and for walkers, they have a stronger sense of control over their environment. So therefore, it impacts them less. Also, there's the health benefit.
By the way, what time do you have to get up at in the morning? To be in work at 9 o'clock, what time do you have to get up at?
6:30. And 2 years ago, it wasn't like this.
Actually, as it happens, in London Listener, I travel from Cavan 5 days a week, 3.5 hours round trip. Traffic has become very bad the last 2 years. Another one, I commute Waterford to Dublin.
Oh my God.
Leave at 5:30 in the morning. I'm home at 9:10 in the evening. Another one, after a 2-hour commute each way every day, and I get hit with BIK, this listener says. My daily commute is somewhere between 2.5 and 3 hours. The horrible N7. I start work at 8:30, so I have to leave Portlaoise at 6:50, and that's not guaranteeing I'll be in time. I have a small child that I can't leave any earlier. Luckily, my employer allows me to finish at 4:30 to try and get a head start. But if I'm home at 6 o'clock, it's been a good day's commute. Conor Faulkner of AAA. Are we back to where we were almost during the Celtic Tiger era?
Yeah, not far off it. And the reason is that the mistakes that we identified during the Celtic Tiger era, the investment that we said we needed to make, we simply haven't done it. And we're perpetuating the problem. And look, this has been discussed an awful lot and everybody who sits in traffic reflects on it. But I think there's a couple of big things. Firstly, we still have not invested the sort of volumes of money in public transport that we know we need to do. Throughout the whole Celtic Tiger period, in Dublin alone, we built 2.5 Lewis lines and a port tunnel and we widened the M50. Now, they were very, very good measures. But as an overall return for a problem that we spent 15 years talking about, it was pathetic. I mean, we simply didn't apply the required resources to the problem. And we're repeating planning mistakes. I mean, Dublin, the other cities are the same, particularly Cork. Galway's got a disproportionate traffic problem, but often we talk about Dublin. And Dublin does its development like an unplanned garden. There's no gardener there laying out paths, you know, pulling up weeds. In Dublin, if you want to do development, you just follow your commercial return. If you're a property developer, you might build on a greenfield site in Naas because you can throw up 40, 50 houses and get your return. Every time you do that, you add 20 or 30 commuting journeys to the M7. Whereas what the city would prefer you to do is what they call brownfield development. So look at sites within Dublin city centre and develop those for housing. But no individual developer is going to do that because they are simply following the line of least resistance or following the line of maximum return. And there's nobody actually joining these things up and planning them properly. Ciarán Cuff, with whom I often fight, wrote a good piece in the Journal yesterday, on the amount of available publicly owned land that exists in Dublin City that could be developed. And every time you do that, instead of building the housing estate in Naas, you contribute to the solution. Every time you do the opposite, you guarantee future problems.
And I promise we will get to solutions later, but the extent of the problems, the traffic jams, the commutes, and this is not just a Dublin issue. I mean, it's surrounding all of Dublin.
Sure.
Galway has had, I mean, Galway is one of the worst places in the country to get stuck in a traffic jam. Even at weekends, you find...
out of all proportion to its size as a city. I mean, Galway is a great city and there's a reason why it's so attractive to so many people and there's lots and lots that's good about it. But in terms of Galway's car dependency, it's even worse than Dublin. And again, there's virtually no public transport provided.
And our other cities, Cork, Waterford, Limerick?
Well, people in Waterford and Limerick will probably give out to me because in relative terms, they do okay. I know that Limerick has significant traffic problems. Waterford can have bad days. Cork genuinely does have a similar sort of traffic problem to Dublin. But again, at the risk of sounding parochial or biased towards the Pale, Dublin is really, you know, it's by an order of magnitude the larger urban area. So you're talking well over 2 million people. So all of the problems that we might discuss in a Galway or a Cork or a Limerick exist in magnified fashion in Dublin. And funnily enough, in Dublin, we've done a bizarre thing. We've almost, well, not solved, but the city centre problem within the canals is a great deal better than it used to be. There are more public transport options. So if you're doing that in and out journey as opposed to an orbital journey, city centre is not too bad. Car volumes in the city centre are down by about 15% in the last 10 years. Cycling numbers have tripled. There is the Lewis extension. There's better bus provision. They've enhanced DART. So the city centre is starting to improve in the way that we would like the whole metropolitan area to, but nothing else has. So you now have on the M50, for example, it's well over 130,000 vehicles per day average. And I would suggest that about half of those people have absolutely no desire to be on the M50 or to be one of those cars causing one of the traffic jams. If they had any sort of public transport alternative, they'd take your hand off. They wouldn't need to be forced. But there they are for want of alternatives. And there they are also demonised by lots of people in the political argument who persist in the comfortable fiction that the source of our problems is that motorists are lazy and just won't do the right thing. And I think that prevents us from actually facing up to our deficiencies and making the investments we need.
I want to bring in Neil Walker, who's head of infrastructure at IBEC, the Irish Business and Employers Confederation. Thank you very much for joining us, Neil. Is this a major issue now for many employers as well, that they're seeing a major issue with actually attracting and retaining staff, who are now finding that, particularly with rents and house prices being prohibitive in our major cities, particularly Dublin, people are now looking at long commutes, but that isn't necessarily good for their ability to contribute as workers.
We see this as a quality of life issue. Yeah, you're trying to attract talent because whereas in the past companies invested and the talent followed, it's the other way around now. And therefore you have to make cities livable. And the big problem with Dublin is it's incredibly dispersed. It has the footprint of Los Angeles. If we'd had less of a legacy of disjointed spatial planning, we'd have a much more compact footprint.
What is the sort of international comparison for the amount of time it should take somebody to get to work? Should people be able to get to work, say, for example, in a half an hour? Should that be the objective?
That is actually a policy objective in the National Development Plan and the National Planning Framework. But the danger of looking at averages, you know, the average commute time around the country is half an hour. But within that, there are people who are spending way over an hour. And the real problem areas, it's not people who live in Dublin City. They have short commutes. It's the surrounding counties. It's the commuter belt where, you know, if you take the likes of Kildare, Wicklow, over one in five of people coming in are spending more than an hour each way.
Okay. This strikes me again, deja vu all over again. This is the type of discussion we were having in the early years of this century. We were talking about the it had been too expensive to buy in Dublin or major cities, about all of the new housing estates been built well away and people have been stuck in their cars. We've been through a housing collapse. Now we have this rental crisis and people can't afford. So we're just going to go back and do exactly what we all hated before.
I wish there was a magic wand and a quick fix. The planning system is part of the problem, and we'll be looking at that as a separate issue as part of our quality of life campaign. I'll come back to that in a couple of weeks' time. But the big problem that we have, as Conor pointed out, is underinvestment for a whole decade.
But does this all come back to housing? I mean, is it the whole thing needs to be integrated, that the whole issue in relation to transport has to be part of our all-housing initiative?
Well, I think that makes sense. But how do you get housing? How do you get private finance to engage property building the types of housing that we want them to build? For good or ill, prior to the economic downturn and the 2008 collapse, people were commenting at the time that we seemed to be throwing up hotels all over Ireland. I mean, people were building hotels in the middle of rural Ireland that never had any long-term viability, really. But they were being built as fast as private capital could build them in response to tax incentives. So we know that the neutral blind force that is sort of capital looking for a return can be channeled in the right directions with the right policies. So why aren't we compelling this private capital to make the sort of development that the city wants? In other words, why aren't there tax breaks for brownfield development, punitive tax treatment for out-of-town development, you know, gearing the engine of private capital to the outcomes that we want.
OK, but we'll get to more of that in a little while, but I want to go back to you, Leslie, because it does strike me, is there a particular age cohort which gets particularly badly affected by this?
Everybody does.
No, I think older people probably don't because they're settled in their homes. Isn't there a group of people in their late 20s, 30s, early 40s, people perhaps who have small children, who have to probably suffer the worst in this regard?
Every group has its cross to bear. Every group. The research is not saying one group is impacted more than another. So let's look at, I see this with the college students. I've got kids who are commuting an hour and a half, 2 hours each way.
Because they can't afford to rent in Dublin.
They can't afford to rent in Dublin, all the associated costs with going to college, that type of thing. So they're commuting from all over the place, 2 to 3 hours, or an hour and a half to 2 hours each way. That impacts the classroom dynamic because they don't get to know their classmates. It impacts things. I set group projects. That impacts group projects. As soon as they can get out of there, they're gone like a shot, and I don't blame them.
So that's not a college existence. That's not your third level existence.
No, it's not. Then we've got people with small kids. And, you know, somebody recently told me a story, a friend of hers, they take the child to the crèche first thing in the morning and they're coming home at night to kiss her goodnight and say goodbye, you know, go to sleep. That's not why you have kids. You know, for that group, myself as somebody having just turned 50, I hate it because I want to go out and do things. I want to meet my friends. I want to enjoy my life. But I'm stuck sitting on a bus getting my head hit with backpacks because we don't have a very good bus etiquette for short people like me. So it impacts all of us in one way or another.
But yet then when you have things like this new initiative to try and change all the bus routes in Dublin, all hell breaks loose and everybody gives out that they don't want change, even when what we have isn't working for us.
Yeah, but here's the thing. Again, I live out in the Finglas Road. We have Hart's Corner. What are they going to do? Knock down all the houses there? You can't extend the road. In certain areas, they're going to extend the road. I think that's fantastic. But there are places where there is nothing we can do. D'Oléir Street, my favorite car park of Dublin. You know, I love the Lewis. I use it. I think it's a great initiative. But I sit there on the bus. It is, as I said, my favorite car park.
Lots of people getting in touch saying things like the Lewis now too full to take, if in particular during rush hours, that when you try and get on, it just isn't possible to get on. Also, commuter trains coming into Dublin from the likes of Maynooth, it's no longer possible to get on in places like Clonsilla. And you were making the point, Leslie Shoemaker, that you would like to have school children put off the normal conventional buses. Now, presumably you'd give them another form of transport.
Absolutely. I, you know, growing up in America, we had school buses, and that took a huge amount of pressure off of the roads. And it would be great because I'm competing for seats in the morning with school kids who are going early too, because you can't get onto the bus after 7:20, and parents bringing little kids to school and things like that. So it's, I think we need to be look to other countries, see what they're doing, what's worked for them, what might work for here, and do that analysis, which it sounds like is starting to happen.
I'm a little sceptical about, I mean, I sympathise with the problem, but looking at school kids and saying, you know, there'll be a lot less congestion if you kids, if it wasn't for you pesky kids. I mean, I think it sort of makes a hierarchy of transport needs. And the school kids' journey is every bit as legitimate as everybody else's.
Maybe it is, but maybe they should be insisted that they do use these school buses instead of parents driving their children to school.
Well, I think one thing that we can definitely do better, because we did in the past, is the number of individuals cycling. And cycling is actually one of the quiet success stories in Dublin over the last 10 years. The numbers have tripled. The canal cordon, which is the sort of city centre area, now has about 12,000 cyclists coming in every morning in the commute, which is brilliant. But school kids just aren't doing it. And in particular, school girls are not doing it.
Well, that's dangerous.
Lots of people say that to me, Matt. And actually, the data does not bear that out. There were 149 people killed on Irish roads last year, which is obviously not good. Nine of them were cyclists, but it's the lowest number in history. You literally have to go back to the Second World War before a time when it was actually less dangerous to cycle on the roads.
That's encouraging.
So a lot of this is perception. But and if you look at how cycle tracks are done in Dublin, you've got a lovely, pristine cycle track. You think, this is grand, I can live with this. It then abandons you at the busy junction. And you just have to make your own way across. And then, Darwinian style, the survivors can pick up the track again on the far side. And if we were thinking it through, we could do that an awful lot better. But it, just as an example, this isn't my suggestion per se, it's been suggested to me by others, but if you look at female secondary school students, I would suggest that all schools should have a trousers option for girls, because one of the reasons why they can't cycle is they're physically prevented doing so by the uniform. We still have individuals carrying, 20 kilo bags full of paper school books, when one tablet with PDFs on it would cover all of that. And I think there's plenty that we could do to encourage students to get back onto bicycles. And that might seem like a very low-tech and unsexy solution, but it really does punch above its weight, and we can do that for lots of people.
I'm conscious that we don't want to be just talking about Dublin, so we're going to briefly go on the phone to Hildegard Nocton, TD for Galway West and South Mayo. Hildegard, would all of the problems of Galway traffic be solved by the Outer Ring Road when it's finally built?
No, it's not the panacea, but it's an important part of the overall picture. There's also the Galway Transport Strategy, which is a huge focus on getting people out of private cars and improving our public bus, our public transport network. And I've been a long time advocate of park and ride facilities on the main approaches to our city. Not everybody wants to bypass the city. Many people are working, you know, in NUI Galway, going to a UHG, working in the city. We also have our business parks, the Ballybrit and the Parkmore Business Park, on the outskirts of the city, just as you come off the Dublin-Galway motorway. And the outer city ring road will certainly improve access for those over 6,000 workers who are working in that facility on a day-to-day basis. So it's a combination of cycle lanes, dedicated cycle lanes, bus lanes, and having public transport that works. We've one really good example in Galway, the 409. I know there's always a lot of negativity around transport in Galway, but the 409 route goes from Air Square to GMIT to the Parkmore Business Park, and it carries I think 1.5 million passengers every year, and that has improved over the years because it's on time, people know it's going to be there, to be there every 8 to 12 minutes at peak time, and it works well. We've got the train from Athenry in Oranmore coming right into the heart of Air Square, and the car park now in Oranmore at the train station is at capacity because it's such a really good service,
and
ways to improve these services.
And yet, though, the perception is that Galway is still largely a car park.
It is. I'm not saying that we don't have traffic issues, but I'm just giving examples of how public transport works well when it's an efficient service. It runs on time, and we need more bus lanes. And part of the whole solution, when we have the outer city ring road, that is going to help us alleviate and open up the road space within our city to allow for dedicated bus lanes, allow for safe cycle lanes. It's all very well saying to people, you know, get the bus or cycle in, and but it's very dangerous around it. You know, Galway is a very medieval city with very narrow streets, so we need to ensure that we have safe cycle lanes for people to use. You talked about school children there. Okay, there's a cultural change here as well, but also making it safe and ensuring that we have safe cycle lanes for people. And this will take investment. And, you know, there's, you know, there's 200 million in plan for public transport in Galway, and the City Council are leading on that. So it's not just the out-of-city bypass, which will be a key part of it, it's also ensuring that we have dedicated park and ride facilities that are in key strategic areas. We've had park and ride facilities that just didn't work. They're in the wrong location, people didn't use them, they had no dedicated bus lane, and the bus is just sitting behind other cars in traffic. That's not going to work. They need to be in key strategic locations, and that's what the Galway Transport Strategy
okay.
is.
Okay, Hildegard Nocton, thank you very much for joining us, Fine Gael TD in Galway. I want to go to Brendan O'Sullivan, in Director of the Centre for Planning, Education and Research at University College Cork. He's a chartered town planner. Brendan, something that Hildegard mentioned there, which isn't unique just to Galway, is that perhaps one of our big problems is that the architecture of our cities doesn't necessarily lend itself to putting in bus lanes and cycle lanes, because unless you actually decide to knock down large streets.
Yeah, I've heard that argument put forward in some locations, but I don't think it's really the city centres that are the problem. It's more to do with the suburbs. Some of the best cities in Europe for cycling are ones that are historic. And Cork is quite a fairly good example at the moment. You probably know that there's been some changes to the way pedestrianisation and limiting car use to certain main streets has freed up the buses going through the town and cycling and so on. And so I think it's less to do with the city centre problem more than the suburbs, the approaches. And as Hildegard said, you know, solutions such as park and ride are extremely important when they're at the best locations. Cork is a very good example.
Cork famously had the Black Ash, wasn't it? Did that actually work? Or people abandon it?
I beg your pardon?
Did people use that when it was available to them?
They do. The Black Ash, which is on the southern end of the city, it's the trick with the park and ride system is that as soon as people arrive into traffic and they see the brake lights coming on and in front, to see have I an option, because increasingly people are going to be, if they have to commute long distance, they will mix their modes. So they may drive the first part, they may take a park and ride, they may get on a suburban rail or a bus, and so these they have to be very carefully chosen where the location is. The park and ride in Cork is actually one of the most financially successful one anywhere because it was well chosen. But it's not going to solve all of our problems.
Okay, Brendan, something else that came up earlier, and I'd be interested to hear what you think of this, because Connor was making the point that you can't do transport in isolation where you're building houses and apartments. And he was arguing particularly to infill what they call brownfield sites, particularly in our cities. Is there an argument to sort of take an awful lot of the planning for houses and stuff out of the responsibility of the local authorities and have somebody like Transport Infrastructure Ireland, who have a tremendous record in building the motorways around the country, put them in charge of the building of the houses, a central unit in the country, somebody who has a track record, and just let them get on with it?
Well, I mean, that sounds a very interesting proposal, but I mean, in reality, in the kind of neoliberal world we're living in, a central agency is never going to be given the responsibility for delivering housing. The reality is here in this country that housing and property development of every kind is done by the private sector primarily. What you really need is adherence to proper planning principles. I mean, most of these issues that have been raised today have been predicted. Often where things go wrong is when authoritative, strongly put together, integrated land use and transportation policies are in place, they're deviated from. In the day-to-day decision-making. And it's not just about where houses are located, it's also where workplaces are located. And in many cases, workplaces pop up, for example, in Galway or other cities, along the ring roads, for example. And these things are notoriously difficult to service with anything other than the private car. And so the argument I would be making, I suppose, is that some of the devil is in the details. So, for example, when a planning application comes in for 600 houses or for a large office development, a lot of attention is paid to environmental impacts on ecology and so on. But there's very little impact assessment of the impact on people's lives. And you know, a little bit of joined up thinking there would make a long would improve things an awful lot.
Okay, example, Brenton, yeah, well, give us quickly that last example, thank you.
Yeah. So for example, you know, we know that if a new housing development is developed, there has to be a bus or a rail option or some kind of option for public transport and alternative from day one, the day that people arrive in. But what we tend to get is a planning permission with conditions saying at some time in the future something will be provided. The reality is that we should be saying no to things that can't develop public transport from day one, and that goes for workplaces as much as for housing.
Okay, Brenton O'Sullivan from UCC, thank you for joining us. Briefly, Neil Walker from IBEC, what about if the Transport Infrastructure Ireland has had massive success in building our motorway network in this country, getting the roads right, doing so, I think, largely on budget and like many other capital projects, why not put people with that expertise in charge of delivering the houses as well as part of the infrastructure?
One of the big problems we have with affordability is the price of land, and at least, you know, the land agency will be looking at state holdings and trying to free up. There's an awful lot of state-owned land, and I think that will help. But centralised house building is not going to happen, you know.
For political reasons?
It would require a different political regime altogether, and I just...
Would it work, though? Would it actually deliver what we actually need? An integrated system of delivering transport according to building houses and apartments in the locations that are beneficial to this country?
It would be helpful to have more social and affordable housing. And I think that the state has a role in that. But not for the general market, no. I don't see.
Now, listener here, Joe says, I moved to Clare with my young family from Dundrum 2 years ago, but we're in Dublin today for Funderland. So we're driving on some of the real hotspots. The traffic is mental. Cyclists are so aggressive, and there's a lack of courtesy from drivers that is shocking. As a born and bred Dub, I can't wait to get out of here later. Now, Peter Cosgrove has joined us. Peter Cosgrove is a future of work expert. Some people are texting in about things like home working, flexi working, but does that actually work? Because of all the talk we've heard in the last 20 years about that being the future of work, most people still go to offices and factories to do their work.
Yeah, listening to the discussion, I mean, we have to realise there's two busy times, our morning and evening. It's because of this getting in for nine and roughly leaving it around 5:30. So the difference is technology works, home working does work. The biggest challenge we have is employers are really struggling with the idea still of people working from home. It's this idea that when someone's working from home, people fundamentally think they're not working. Whereas actually the best thing an employer can do, because what we're hearing is people are travelling 2 hours a day, the stress, the fact if you've got somebody who's coming into work and has just commuted for 2 hours, you're not getting someone at their best. So you need to let people work where the work needs to be done. That means they absolutely need to come into work. But this idea that they have to be in at nine, and then people are getting so stressed when they're 4 or 5 minutes late. If you as an employer say, I need you to get the work done and I don't care where you are to get it done, actually both sides benefit.
But Leslie Shoemaker, does working at home, you're a counselling psychologist, does it actually help people? I mean, do people not get lonely at home? Do they not get bored by not having the mental stimulation of interacting with other people?
Well, I think you have some types of individuals who would prefer that kind of lone type of existence, and that's grand. I think research is showing if you have a mix of both being in the office and out of the office working from home, I think it's really effective. Like, I offer Skype sessions, and I do that from home, and I really enjoy it. And yes, I confess, I put on the nice pink fluffy slippers and have my cup of tea next to me. And, you know, it's lovely to be in my own environment and my own comfort zone. And it's, again, within my control, and I enjoy the days I do work from home, but I also enjoy going into the office and seeing my coworkers, and you know, we have a laugh and get things done. But I'm in a shared office, so it sometimes benefits me to be at home because there's an awful lot of noise there.
Neil Walker of IBEC, is it the case, as Peter Cosgrove has suggested, that a lot of employers think that basically if you stay at home, you're not working, that you might you have limited productivity from people who work from home?
I don't think that's right at all. I think progressive employers have a very, very good attitude towards flexible working. And indeed, it's probably the way of the future, because there just aren't going to be enough roads to get everybody. I mean, the population is growing so quickly, the whole place is going to seize up unless we have other options.
Of course, one of the reasons it's seizing up is because of all the damn deliveries from Amazon and all the rest of it. But that's something else we might talk about another day. But Peter Cosgrove, are a lot of employers going to miss out on getting the right people now because people are just going to say, well, I'm not going to commute for a long time?
Yeah.
Are people going to start turning down jobs and go for lesser paying jobs in places where they have a shorter commute.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to be a case of choice. When someone says they're working 2 hours a day, they are choosing that. There is more than one job out there. We are at a full employment workplace, but unfortunately, maybe the best paid job is the one 2 hours away, and we need to think about it. And I think it's important to say that when people are working flexibly, they should be coming into the office. I just think people should start at 8 or up to 10 and maybe leave at 4 or up to 7. So it's about giving people that lack of stress when they come in the morning. And I think that's the thing people are struggling with. And as I said, the technology can do it, but lots of the studies have shown that when you give people flexible working, they're less likely to get promoted. So even though people are very much focused on giving people this, they're less likely to actually get to the next level because it's an unconscious bias around
that.
You
look shocked by that, Neil.
Well, I that's news to me.
I can tell you that employers are pragmatic, and I know because look, we've over 300 people on South William Street in Dublin at the heart of the traffic problem, about 500 nationwide. But employers do get pragmatic, and when labour is tight, employers will look at things like flexi working. Going back about 10, 12 years ago, the last time there was a real pinch on labour, a lot of employers got women back into the workplace, often women who had, you know, gone through their first maybe 10 years of getting their kids through the early stage. And you were now talking about a demographic of very reliable, solid potential employees who just had a bit of work-life balance issues, which in years gone by wouldn't have been entertained. But in the modern world, people say, yes, it is worth it. Let's be flexible for this employee. She will pay me back. And that, in a way, is what's happening now. And there's no doubt when you're trying to recruit a Java developer or something like that, which are as rare as hen's teeth and very expensive, you will find that, you know, people won't just look at how much money you're paying them. They will look at the quality of life in your city, how flexible an employer is willing to be, and they will look at those things holistically. And so do employers, and they're doing it for pragmatic reasons rather than for ideological ones. But I think it's happening.
OK, we're out of time, but I just very briefly to sum up, just each of you in about 20 seconds, give me one solution you would like introduced almost immediately to solve the problem of excessive commuting. Conor Faulkner?
Invest in public transport. I've been like a broken record saying it for 20 years, but it's still true because I haven't done it.
Leslie?
I'm following Conor.
OK, that's nice. Neil Walker?
And I agree with both of you, but you need to fix the planning system because the money's there, but if it's tied down in Bolplanola in the courts, it won't happen.
Last word to you, Peter Cosgrove.
Offer flexible working, but get the senior executives to take it because if they don't lead by example, other people won't take it.
Thank you all very much for joining us here on The Last Word on Today FM.
The Last Word with Matt Cooper on Today FM.